Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what exactly is just war theory, and can it be applied to modern warfare? But first, is humanity the most damaging predator on Earth? Our next guests say yes, and that its predatory practices may be disrupting evolution. With us are the authors of the study. Chris Derrimont and Tom Reimken are professors of geography at the University of Victoria, BC, and Heather Bryan is a postdoctoral fellow there in the Applied Conservation Science Lab. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Heather Bryan, Chris Derrimont, and Tom Reimken. Great to have you here with us. I thought perhaps we could start with the origins of the study, which I understand is from this history, this deep history of the idea of sustainability. Tom Reimken, this is your area. How did this originate?
It sort of is rooted in a field study that I began in about 1975 on a very remote lake on the west coast of Canada. And I was trying to basically evaluate some pretty basic ecological processes in this lake where I was studying this small fish called the stickleback, and I'd found actually there were about 22 species of predators that were utilizing this small fish, and they included loons and grebes and trout and otters, and I built up quantitatively a sort of a total consumption for each of these 22 species of predators. And very simply, I found that none of the predators really took even up to 5%. It was usually 1% to 5% of the prey population. And I thought that was sort of interesting that there were so many predators that they were taking such a small amount when it seemed clear they could have taken a lot more. And also noticed that virtually none of them were taking the adult fish. They were all taking the young ones. This seemed to contrast dramatically with what I could see in adjacent marine waters where human fishers were taking individually, we're taking about 50% of the total prey biomass, for example, of herring, of salmon, and we were targeting the reproductive adults. And this fundamental disconnect between us as a predator versus all these sort of natural predators, which obviously had persisted in these communities for a long time, set in motion the origin of this paper.
And so one of the ideas also pertain to how we define sustainability and how we research sustainability, according to your paper. What had been the general definition of sustainability with regards to these ecosystems before, and how had they been studied? Chris Derrimont?
Sure. When a new student in a fisheries class, for example, first hears his or her first lesson on sustainable exploitation, what he or she listens to is a model, an idea that speaks to sustaining yields to humanity, that is harvest, that is maximizing the long-term steady-state biomass that flows out of ecosystems and to human beings. And that's served humanity awfully well in the past few decades, but it's becoming clear that that sort of biomass removal clearly has cost to ecosystems. And it contrasts very much with the ideas that Tom just spoke to and the idea that non-human predators, these natural predators, can serve as models of sustainable exploitation. After all, they've stood the test of time in, by and large, not having the drastic impacts on populations that we humans do.
And so when you studied the predators in terms of human predation, it seems you focused primarily on non-huge commercial types of farms, right? This is out in wild areas.
That's right. I think that Heather Bryan, our colleague, could best answer the sort of composition of the database, which was indeed exclusively over wild foods in nature.
Heather Bryan.
Sure. And this again comes from Tom's original idea that we might shift our idea of sustainability to one that involves looking at natural predators that have evolved for millennia with their prey as examples of ultimate sustainability. And so what we did is we compared the rates at which humans exploit wild species and compared them with the rates at which natural non-human predators in both marine and terrestrial ecosystems exploit wild species. And we looked at ecosystems spanning the entire planet, drawing on published studies over mostly from the 1990s. And we were able to compare both marine and terrestrial systems, which is something that many other studies haven't tackled.
So humanity, human predators, they tend to, first of all, be more damaging, seems to be your primary finding, than other predators. Let's go through all of why that is. Chris Dermott?
Humans have evolved culturally, technologically, economically, and so forth to become what we refer to as this super predator, this predator of predators, which is a key finding in our paper, a predator with remarkable ecological and evolutionary costs to ecosystems. And there are several, I think, maybe tipping point moments over time, probably starting a long, long time ago with the development of projectile weapons, starting with simple throwing utensils that could dispatch an animal without having to engage with it. Predators lead very dangerous lifestyles in that they have to often physically interact with prey, and that can sometimes lead to their demise. So that was an early game changer. Let's fast forward to, say, the 1940s and 50s, where marine technology, industrial fish boats had the capacity to stay out at sea and freeze fish out at sea, was another game changer in that no longer would they have to cut their predatory missions short and head back to market. The fish could be frozen. And it's just hasn't stopped since then with global trade in seafood products, some remarkable technologies that allow us to search, pursue, and capture prey. I'm thinking, for example, of spotting planes that fly above the oceans in Alaska looking for herring balls and direct boats on the waters to those schools of fish. Thinking of giant nets that can scour the ocean floor. I'm thinking of, for example, modern projectile weapons that can bring down a large carnivore from almost half a mile away. These are remarkable technological accomplishments, but they've had enormous ecological costs to the prey and we exploit in the ecosystems that ultimately support us.
Tom Reimken, what would you add?
Well, there is, I think, two additional issues that sort of encompass this issue of the super predator, and that is the millions of years of adaptation that prey have coexisted, co-evolved with their predators have led to this sort of litany of huge adaptations, behavioral adaptations, morphological activity. All of these things are basically to cope, to minimize the likelihood of the sort of a successful predatory event. But as this works, you know, the predators co-evolve. And so what we see in the real world is sort of this balance, this equilibrium. And there is no adaptation that any prey have that basically is free of our skill set. And so Chris has sort of alluded to that. So basically, these prey here have now encountered this predator from which the last million years have provided no sort of capacity to cope with. The other thing that makes us a particularly dramatic predator that differs from so many others, which I sort of, we both have alluded to here, and that is that we tend to target the reproductive capital, which sort of is this disconnect with what we find in the vast majority of these other predators, which are targeting the reproductive interest. And obviously the metaphor here is not that complicated, but it's quite profound, and that no system will persist if the capital is continually targeted. And that is the main target of our capture. And so this is ultimately sort of part and parcel of the complete lack of sustainability when we enter the fray. So
one of the things that you have found in your paper is that people target the large, the big, rather than the juveniles. Is that what you're talking about when you talk about reproductive capital?
Yes, it is. In fisheries, we have this concept called yield per recruit. And that is sort of, it doesn't make sense to catch a baby, you know, because if you let it live another year, it would be, you know, much heavier. And if you let it live another year, it's going to be even heavier yet. So you can very easily model a situation where what is most cost effective? Well, what's most cost effective is this, where you have the maximum yield, right, basically, for any individual. And that basically is coincidental with the entry into the adult size classes, which is the reproductive capital. So it's the nature of our fishing science that almost invariably demands that we target these size classes just as they enter the reproductive class.
And so that, you're saying, has a negative impact on culling than
Absolutely.
Other animals.
Yeah.
Heather, let's bring you back in here. So this is primarily hunters and fishers. I mean, what if we extended that out to other ways that animals were used by humanity? Would it just make the model go completely crazy?
It's kind of an interesting comparison. I guess if you think about it from the perspective of how we use domestic animals, we've selected for desirable traits over hundreds of years that allow us to benefit from products like milk, selecting for higher milk production, and traits that ultimately benefit us. Whereas in wild populations, we can see some effects of our harvesting that have potentially negative evolutionary effects on populations. So this sort of comparison, but also an example of how we differ in terms of different types of impacts that we can have on animals.
And what about the quantification? You had some numbers in terms of how different the rates are between us, the super predators, and others.
The most striking findings were from marine systems, were that we take about 14 times higher on typically prey from the oceans compared with single species of natural predator, which is fairly dramatic, and that was just the sort of median or middle rate, and in some cases we take much higher than single species of natural predator. What was interesting on land is that although we didn't take more overall compared with single species of natural predators, we differed in how we take species on different trophic levels. So if you actually look at some of the large carnivores, we take up to 9 times the typical rate of natural predators. And natural predators on large carnivores tend to be other large carnivores.
There are two types of impacts that we've been talking about. One is about the evolutionary shifts. Another is potential extinctions. And then a third one seems to be about global food chains. So how could we break out these consequences from this super predator type of activity? Chris Darmont?
Well, clearly human predators have emerged as a pretty potent agent of evolution, both in kind of the macro sense, in that overexploitation has led to a major evolutionary process that is extinction in many taxa over the last several hundred or more years, even thousands of years, since we've evolved as proficient hunters. But you've mentioned something really interesting, that is the more subtle microevolutionary changes, that is to say, changes that happen on contemporary sort of decadal type timescales, in which commonly, and especially in marine fishes, we're seeing effects like shrinking size at age. That is to say, fishes are getting smaller at a given age than they once were even a decade or two ago, or effects like shrinking horns on bighorn sheep and so on. And also in the marine world, shifts in reproductive schedules. Fishes are beginning to breed at younger ages and at smaller sizes. And all this is precipitated by the very different phenotypic targets or targets of selection that hunters and fishers impose on that reproductive capital, those large adults, which in effect gives a selective advantage to those individual fish that grow slower, that reproduce early and get some reproduction done before they enter the larger size classes and have very low probabilities of surviving another year. And I think another interaction between evolution and ecology, and that is when fishes in particular are breeding earlier and at smaller sizes, they tend to be less fecund, that is to say they have less offspring, and that can have a demographic effect on populations, populations that breed earlier because of our evolutionary forcing. Tend to be less resilient in the face of continued heavy harvests.
And so let's bring this back to where we started. Tom Reinken, let's bring you back. Given the study's findings, should we redefine sustainability? And if so, how?
Well, if we continue to harvest the capital at the rates we are, there is no such sustainability possible at a community level. We will probably, like we have seen, is a gradual erosion of the numbers of all the competitors. So we can maintain high levels at the expense of these other species. So if we're talking about ecological sustainability in the long term, where the entire community persists, clearly we have to do is we have to shift down to quotas that are representative of what we find in other predators, and that is typically less than 5%. And we have to shift to obviously the size classes that in fact are representative of what the typical sort of what we call the J-shaped survivorship curve is in so many fishes. So if we embed ourselves among those, then I believe long-term sustainability is probably a fait accompli. But without those changes, you can micromanage indefinitely, but there will sort of be no solution without those two initial changes that we've talked about.
Chris Darramont?
Yeah, Tom brings up some excellent points, so some guidance from non-human predators, that is, target the young if possible and don't take too much. These are simple rules that most non-human predators that have persisted in ecological communities for millennia or millions of years demonstrate for humanity. And I acknowledge, and we all acknowledge, and even in the paper, that there are enormous cultural and economic barriers against such shifts. But that being said, some fisheries show great promise in, for example, shifting the target of harvest to juvenile size classes. And in fact, the Pacific herring fishery provides a really nice illustration of what is possible.
Toward the end of your paper, you had a list of potential solutions, and some of them would probably need some explanation, like you talked about. Well, first of all, cultivating tolerance for carnivores, which I thought was interesting. Why don't we talk about that as well within this context? What do you mean by tolerance for carnivores?
We think the solutions are much more clear-cut in terms of safeguarding large carnivore populations into the future. Although there are economic drivers of those harvests, there is much more opposition to harvests. And that is to say that the social license that society once granted to trophy hunters, those that hunt not for food, but for trophy, is quickly eroding. And the global moral outrage shown after Cecil the Lion was killed sends a signal that this is indeed true. So what managers and campaigners and conservationists and indeed managers can do is help society change policy about large carnivore hunting to reflect what most members of societies believe to be a hunting activity that belongs in the history books and not in a day and age where large carnivores are so quickly disappearing.
And another potential solution that you put forward in your paper was supporting community leadership in fisheries. What does that mean?
In fisheries management, you can study the fish till the cows come home or the salmon come home, but often good management comes down to managing people. And in a global meta-analysis published 3 or 4 years ago, the common denominator in well-managed fisheries that haven't been diminished like so many others is local leadership and management on local scales. Decentralized management so that humans are managing resources in their backyard or back lakes or back nearshore waters, for example. And they'll tend to make good decisions when there are leaders in communities that recognize the long view, a view that doesn't overexploit the reproductive capital at the expense of that capital for future human generations. So that would be another step in the right direction for sure.
Would it also be a step in the right direction to decrease the consumption of these animals? I've read in some of the IPCC and other climatology reports that our desire for eating so much meat is actually also bad for the climate. It sounds like it's also bad for our fisheries and everything else. What about some proposal to that effect? Tom Reimken.
Yeah, I think I'd rather defer to Chris on that one. So.
Well, Chris, you're the lead author.
Sure. Clearly, especially set against the background of a still rapidly increasing human population that in fact is not decreasing its demand for meats and even wild meats, in fact increasing its demand, any social or management or marketing process that can ease the demand for wild foods will certainly do wild populations a favor. But there are some awfully big economic and cultural processes happening that make that unlikely. So I'm afraid my view on that is not overly optimistic, but I suspect, and this wasn't the intention of our paper, but I suspect when people think about predators now, I hope they think about humanity, and I think they think about what may be staring at them from their dinner plates many nights and week and might start to ponder what some of the ecological and evolutionary costs of those meals might be.
Tom Reimken.
There are a few issues that we sort of haven't brought up. And one is sort of the method by which we could shift from the reproductive classes down to the subadults or to the juveniles. And this is one of the issues here of, like on our coast, we have one of the more commonly caught fishes are rock fishes, which reproducing at 15 years of age, but they can live for 100 years. And so we have to throw the young ones back and we keep the larger ones. But the egg production, if you catch an adult rockfish, the egg production may be 2 million individuals, but when it was only 25% smaller, it would only have produced 100,000 or 200,000. So by taking out the larger individuals, we're effectively sort of collapsing the reproductive potential of that whole community. But the issue is how do you shift a capture technique such that you now specifically can target the subadults? And here we can have flexible hooks. You can have nets that basically allow the larger fish to escape before they're brought to the surface. So these are the things that I think practically the technology is already in place, at least in marine habitats, where it would not be technically difficult to gradually shift our demand into the size classes that predators are in fact primarily taking, and then therefore reduce the quotas accordingly. So those are the several issues that I think need to be addressed by society to bring the shifts in place that we're postulating.
Thank you, all three of you, Heather Bryan, Chris Darmont, and Tom Reimken. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thanks, Maria.
Chris Darmont and Tom Reimken are professors of geography at the University of Victoria, BC, and Heather Bryan is a postdoctoral fellow there in the Applied Conservation Science Lab. When we come back, what exactly is just war theory, and can it be applied to modern warfare? Stay tuned. Thank you. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. President Obama articulated his plan to destroy the group that calls itself ISIS, invoking the long-held philosophy, just war theory. But, he added, we need a new conception of the old philosophy. What exactly is just war theory, and can it be applied here? Three experts join us. Jeff McMahon is a professor of philosophy at Rutgers University. He is the author of Killing in War, The Ethics of Killing, Problems at the Margins of Life, and Ethics in Humanity. Heather Roth Perkins is a professor of international studies at the University of Denver. She is the author of Global Justice, Kant, and the Responsibility to Protect, A Provisional Duty. Tom Gregory is a lecturer of political studies at the University of Auckland, and he's the author of Drones, Mapping the Legal Debate. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. I want to start with just war theory itself. Jeff McMahon, I thought, given your op-ed piece in the New York Times, you should start by giving us the background and how you see it fitting today.
I think of just war theory not as a single theory, but as a tradition of thought about the ethics of war that has in the past been informed by theological speculation, but has over the past 100 years or so become increasingly secular in its content. And there's a lot of disagreement among people who write about the ethics of war as to the content of what we all call just war theory. So it's not as if there's some one theory or doctrine that we all have and use and deploy to evaluate particular war symbols and their application were clear and uncontentious. That's not the case. Though there's probably more agreement in this area than in a lot of areas of ethics, in that almost everybody agrees that there are certain principles that are really important, principles of necessity, proportionality, the justice of the cause, and so on. There's wide agreement about the need for principles of that sort. There's a lot of disagreement about how these principles are to be understood.
These concepts, necessity, proportionality, what exactly do they mean? And can you apply them to today's conflicts?
I would say that most just war theorists over the past few hundred years and contemporary just war theorists agree that there are a number of principles that are important for assessing the permissibility of going to war. These include traditionally a requirement of just cause, which has traditionally just been interpreted to mean that there must be some kind of aim that is itself justifiable or good. I think a lot more interpretive work needs to be done about that to explain why certain causes or aims are just rather than just good. The requirement of proportionality is the requirement that the war should not be expected to cause harm that's excessive in relation to the importance of the aims to be achieved and that could be expected to be achieved. And this requirement, of course, takes into account probabilities, in my view. The requirement of necessity is different in that it requires that there be no other less destructive, less harmful means of achieving just aims. These are very oversimplified descriptions of these requirements, I should say. You can take the study of these requirements about as deep as you want when you start taking account of numbers of people, different types of harms and benefits, probabilities and risks, and people who are liable to be harmed, people who are not liable or innocent in the relevant sense. You know, harms to different people may have different weights or may count differently because of what they have done, whether they're in the right, whether they're in the wrong, and so on. Then there is a set of principles that are meant to govern the actual conduct of war rather than just the resort to war. And traditionally, it has been thought that the principles governing the resort to war and the principles governing conduct in war were entirely distinct, so that the permissibility of conduct in war was separate from and independent of the aims of the war, so that people could be fighting in a permissible way even if they didn't have aims that were justifiable. That traditional view has been challenged in recent years by a number of contemporary just war theorists, and I think it's probably safe to say that that really very important traditional view that dominated just war theory for a few hundred years at least is now no longer the dominant view among contemporary thinkers about just war, though, of course, it is still defended by many.
We've got a situation where Syria is quite a mess. President Obama has declared that he's going to wipe out this group called ISIS. Can we apply just war theory to the current circumstances? Heather Ross, what would you say?
Of course you can. And in fact, you should. I think that President Obama's aims need to be justified. We need to make a proportionality calculation. Jeff explained, proportionality calculations are forward-looking. We can look quite far into the future. But all of the goods that would result need to be related to that just cause in a pretty direct way, I think. And all of the harms have to be balanced against that. So when President Obama claims things like we're going to wipe out ISIS, we need to understand what wiping out means. We also need to understand the long-term foreseeable harms regionally as well as for the United States, as well as for the global system. And then we need to balance those against what we mean by going to war or limited war and these types of things. So I think those types of calculations or at least estimations need to be made, as well as a justification for going. And if this is self-defense, if that's the just aim, if it's defense of others, those types of claims, as well as the probability of success, right? If you make a very large claim that you're going to wipe out ISIS, you need to have, I think, a pretty good estimation that you can do that. So I think the jus ad bellum principles that Jeff demarcated at the beginning are completely applicable to this conflict. And in fact, they should be at the forefront of the discussion.
Tom Gregory.
Well, I'm interested in this question, I guess, from a slightly different perspective. And that's what I see as the kind of disconnect between what people expect just war theory to do and what it ends up doing in practice. I think a lot of people view just war theory as a kind of external force that can act on conflict from the outside. It can provide objective criteria where we can assess whether particular acts of violence are just or unjust, whether the war itself is just or unjust. But there's this notion that it's a kind of external force that can limit, drain the violence that's enacted on battlefield. It's becoming increasingly clear, and a number of kind of critical scholars have started to point to this, that actually just war theory may play a part in enabling the very violence that it's supposed to restrain or limit, that militaries are becoming very adept at appropriating these principles and using them as a way of legitimizing, of authorizing, of normalizing the violence that they're unleashing, and giving conflict a kind of moral certainty that perhaps it would otherwise not deserve. I don't think it deserves. And it maybe ends up drawing attention away from the more kind of horrific effects of conflict, that we end up losing sight of what actually happens to the people affected by war.
Jeff McMahon, what would you say to that?
I would say that any theory can be twisted or used and abused. But the point of just war theory is to discover and tell us what the limits of permissible military action are. It's certainly not to function as a tool for people who want to pursue their own ends. Well, I don't think just war theory really has a point or a function. I mean, international law does. That's something that we make. And we make up laws, and we have a purpose when we're appealing to laws. We're trying to control, limit, restrain war through law. I don't see that as what just war theory does. It doesn't have an aim. It's really rather a body of truths that we're trying to discover about what is permissible and what's not permissible. And people can use the language, the jargon, the labels, just cause, proportionality, and so forth in ways that distort them for their own purposes. But of course, that's true of any kind of moral theory and its application to any other activity. So people can deploy moral concepts and when they're trying to justify all kinds of wrongful behavior. And this is just a hazard that's common to all moral theories and all moral thinking, that apologists for wrongdoing can deploy the concepts that are there for illicit purposes. But that's not at all surprising. It's certainly not something that I think you can blame just war theory for. What just war theorists are trying to do is really genuinely to understand what it's permissible to do and what it's not permissible to do.
Heather Roth, I remember in one of your papers you said even terrorists think they're acting in a just way. They think they're legitimately acting.
The paper that you're referring to, terrorists appropriate the language of self-defense, which is tied to the question of whether or not self-defense is a just cause, and then what are the conditions for self-defense. The just war tradition that Jeff is referring to, normally the jus ad bellum criteria have to be taken together and in concert, right? So you have to satisfy all of them for a permission to fight. So the piece that you referred to that I wrote was really looking at how terrorists have appropriated the discussion of self-defense as a just cause more under like the international legal terms, such as like Article 51 and things like this is kind of problematic, right? I think what just war theorists are trying to do and trying to understand is it's not just static. In fact, a lot of contemporary work going on says, look, you can't just make just calculations under jus ad bellum and then it just ends, right? Then you have this permissible way to fight. In fact, presumably you ought to review the aims of your war throughout the conflict and see if those aims are matching up. Work by David Rodin, for example, on what he calls jus terminatio, says, look, you should consistently revise and go through these calculations again and again. Gerald Mollendorf, for example, says, you know, is it just to end war with jus ex bello? I mean, there's all sorts of types of questions being asked that are about these moral truths, right? When is it okay to continue fighting? When ought we to end? When ought we to go? Who is a permissible target to kill? When is that not okay? And so those are not legal questions per se. Sometimes they overlap with law, but they're distinctly moral questions that I think a good reflective person ought to be asking at the outset of a conflict.
And then perhaps you have to have the law to sort of back it up in some way. Before we look at some of the circumstances that we're dealing with today a little bit more closely, I wanted to take a look historically. Jeff McMahon, why don't I put it to you first? When you look at the wars of past, could you say there have been just wars?
There have been a number of just wars, of course. They are wars primarily of defense against wrongful aggression, where the defense is necessary and proportionate. An example that a lot of people think is quite obvious would be the Second World War. Now, when we say that the Second World War was a just war, what we might mean there is just simply that the conditions were met for permissible warfare on the Allied side. Doesn't mean that everything that the Allies did was just. It just meant that there was an actual moral justification for war against Nazi Germany and the other Axis powers. And I think that that's true. I think that war was necessary against those adversaries, and it could have been proportionate, and that there was a just cause, so on and so forth. So I think that the conditions for a just war were met in that case. Again, that doesn't mean that everything that the Allied powers did in the course of that war was permissible. I think there was a lot that the Allies did that was impermissible. For example, I think that Britain and the United States engaged in terrorism on unprecedented levels, levels that have not been seen since then by the very worst terrorist groups that the world has. Nothing has happened on the kind of scale of Dresden, Hamburg, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Tokyo. But still, I think that was a just war in the sense that I gave, that the conditions were met for permissible action. Someone with a better understanding of military history than I have could go back through history and list a very, very great many just wars. And it's important to make this qualification. What I mean by just war is war on one side. So if I said earlier World War II was a just war, that was actually a mistake. You can't say that a war that involves both sides fighting is just or unjust. What I should have said is war by the Allied powers was just in those circumstances, and war by Germany, Italy, and Japan was unjust. And that kind of thing is going to be true of a great many wars of the past, where you find that one side had justification and the other did not.
And this is Heather Roth, and a great many wars where both sides are unjust.
That is certainly possible, too.
The point that you bring up about the acts of terrorism brings in the issue of technology, which is something that Heather, you've looked at, and also Tom has looked at, in terms of using these new technologies. Obviously, nuclear war is going to annihilate far more than the combatants. And I know that in just war theory, you're supposed to protect civilians. So with today's weapons, drones, nuclear, chemical, biological warfare, how do you conceive of using them with just war theory? Can you maintain within the parameters of the morality if you're using these technologies? Heather, why don't you start?
My work mostly looks at things like lethal autonomous weapons and cyber warfare. And I think the principles with which I work, the just war tradition with which I work, informs those views quite heavily. So, for example, lethal autonomous weapons, I don't think that if these weapons were ever to result, would ever be just to use. But drones, for example, are in the eye of the beholder. Functionally, they're not much different than any standoff weapon we have. The pilots who fly them use targeting practices used throughout all military, at least the U.S. military, through all branches. So in that sense, the technology itself, I don't think, is really anything new. But in terms of things like chemical weapons, anything that's inherently indiscriminate, the weapon itself inherently indiscriminate, would be immoral on just war and international legal grounds, because you have to be able to discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. So technology is both a good and a bad, and it's really how you use it that will justify when you're allowed to use something and when you're not.
Tom Gregory?
I've been following some of the debates within just war theory about the use of remotely piloted drones and other new technologies, some of the debates about the legalities of these as well. And what struck me about both sides of the debate is that it's a strangely disembodied account of what is a very embodied practice, that we end up with a discussion about the ethics of war that is kind of loses sight of what actually happens to the people targeted by these weapons. We get a very clean, very sanitized, very bloodless narrative about war that I think circumnavigates some of the really important moral and ethical questions that arise from destruction of the body in war, wounding in war. So there's been some really fascinating work, I think, from people coming from the feminist tradition, people like Adriana Cavero, Hannah Arendt, Primo Levi gave a little earlier, about the actual destruction of the body. What happens, what's significant, morally significant about the body as when it's destroyed? We get a sanitized discussion about drones, the kind of surgical strikes, warheads on foreheads. The body's blown to bits. It's blown to smithereens. If you read some of the kind of very harrowing, very disturbing accounts of the aftermath of these attacks, you hear about people's bodies being blown into, literally to heaps of flesh and bone, that people are unable to differentiate between what is animal flesh and what's human flesh. They're unable to even bury the victims because they're unsure about what parts of the body belongs to who. And I think there's a moral significance to the destruction of the body, that you're not just killing somebody, you are almost obliterating them as a person. You're destroying their individuality. And I think there's important questions to be asked around that. And I think that maybe the just war framework doesn't necessarily allow us to kind of have those discussions. So I'd want to kind of broaden it out a bit to engage with those kinds of issues.
War has always involved killing and destroying people's bodies. If I'm going to be killed, it doesn't matter a whole lot whether I'm killed by just having a lance struck through my face and through my brain or through my heart, or whether my body is blown into tiny bits. I'm dead either way. And that's the important thing. It seems to me what's really important in war is discriminating between the people who are morally liable to be attacked, that is, the people who have done something that makes them actually legitimate targets of attack, people the targeting of whom is actually going to do some good and can be justified on the basis of the fact that they themselves, the people who are being attacked, are responsible for some grave wrong that can be prevented only by attacking them in this way. And it seems to me that drones are, as Heather said, fundamentally radically different from weapons of mass destruction like nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, in that they are potentially capable of more discriminating targeting than the weapons of war that have characterized the use of force in the 20th century and even earlier than that, in that these are weapons that can hover indefinitely above the target area, continuously surveying and monitoring the area to find out who's there. They can watch the people that they're thinking of trying to attack. And so there may be all kinds of things that are worrying about drones, in particular that they can be used without much risk to those who operate them. And what that means is that they may be more readily resorted to just because they can be used comparatively safely in this way. So they reduce the deterrence of of war and the use of weapons, but to the extent that they can be used in a more discriminating way to attack only those people who are morally liable and not those people who are not morally liable, that's an advance, even if the use of the drone does blow the victims to bits. Imagine the only way that I can prevent a murderer from killing a small child is to blow the murderer to bits. Otherwise, he's going to kill the small child. Well, in that case, he's liable to be killed. It's perfectly permissible to blow him to bits.
I think the good way to bridge Jeff's point with Thomas's point is to look at the narrative of justification. To Tom's point, he's talking about a narrative of biopolitics, right? And so the justification and the modes of justification start to turn on something of biopower, right? Like, this is a cancer, we have to cut it out, it's surgical, it's so easy, it's the right thing to do. And so those narratives start to justify in a different way than traditional defensive narratives, right? But defensive on, like, somebody's attacking me at the moment. We're thinking that a cancer is attacking me, but it's this nameless, faceless virus. So on the biopolitics side, I think Tom's right that we have to be very concerned with the biopolitical narrative. But Jeff is also equally right that if you're liable to be killed, it matters very little how you're killed. You've done something wrong to make yourself liable to be killed. And so whether or not you're blown to bits or not, war is nasty, and we should always think about how awful war is, which is one of the limiting reasons why we don't want to go to war, is because we see limbs on the side of the road. We see horrors happen. It's supposed to be the most terrible thing you can do. So you should be thinking about the terrible nature of war and what it's going to do to the human body, and that should stop you from engaging in it too easily.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about just war theory and the ethics and morality of war in a modern setting. There are three more areas I wanted to get to. One of them is about arming the counterinsurgency as a strategy. One deals with language such as collateral damage, and one deals with occupation. Occupying Iraq for as long as the U.S. did, occupying Afghanistan. Can these fit in with the ideas of having a just war? Jeff McMahon?
Yes. Arming insurgent forces can be permissible, and military occupation of another country can also be permissible, but everything depends on the details. It's difficult right now to know how to fight against both the Assad regime in Syria and the ISIS people who are in control in certain areas in Syria. These are both groups whose aims are really quite terrible. And both of these groups of people have engaged in massive violations of human rights in the region, if I can use that coded terminology, and both will continue to do so unless they're stopped. How to stop them is an entirely different matter. One of the problems is, and this is obvious, is that there are so few reliable, decent, organized forces in the area. This is an area that seems to be controlled by different groups of dreadful warlord types. And it's hard to find anybody that we can support without having to go in ourselves. And that doesn't seem to be a very attractive option to anybody. So whether arming some insurgent forces in Syria is going to be effective, I don't know. One of the problems, again, I'm not saying anything new, is that if they get defeated, the weapons that we give them go right into the hands of the people that we oppose. Military occupations can, of course, be justified, it seems to me. I think the Allied occupation of Germany after the Second World War was justified, and the American occupation of Japan after the Second World War was clearly justified as well. These were cases in which order and control needed to be imposed, and we needed to ensure that the regimes that had been defeated weren't able to rearm and begin fighting again. But whether an occupation of Syria could be just would depend a lot on whether it had any prospect of succeeding in producing a just order there that would be compatible with the desires and values of the people who would be being subject to the occupation. It seems to me highly doubtful.
Tom Gregory?
If I can be a little bit rude and backtrack a little just to the issue of targeted killings, though I take both Jeff and Heather's point, I think it's important to stress that, you know, we're in a situation now where almost 3,500 people have been killed in Pakistan alone by drone strikes, almost 1,000 civilians. And so whilst there may be people who are liable to attack because of their actions, who perhaps deserve to be targeted, the human costs of this conflict are incredibly great. And I do think there is some moral significance for the families of the people targeted that they can't bury their relatives, that civilians killed in these attacks, you know, are effectively denied a death, denied a funeral. So it's a case of kind of broadening terms of the debate in that respect. I guess the general point I'd make, not being a philosopher, I'm more interested in perhaps some of the repercussions that these conflicts have further down the line. Again, I appreciate the points about attempts to kind of develop or devise a more forward-looking just war theory. But there are questions time and time again about possibility of blowback, the fact that often these conflicts have unforeseeable, unintended consequences further down the line that end up causing more harm than good in the long run. And I guess deep down, one of my kind of issues is just war theory kind of brackets off war as a legitimate area of inquiry, that war is already taken as a legitimate form of activity, so long as it meets certain requirements, which may have various levels of restrictiveness. But war itself is legitimate as long as it satisfies these requirements. And being an incredibly unfashionable but still unrepentant pacifist, unhappy about conceding that ground. I want to reopen that question up. And I admit I'm on shaky ground. If you push me too hard, I'm going to struggle to justify my pacifism. But I still want to have war opened up as a legitimate area of concern. I want to kind of think about the consequences of war in ways that perhaps just war theory doesn't necessarily allow us to. A presumption in favour of peace rather than a presumption always in favour of war.
Heather?
I hate to sound like the answers are always there, like there's some crystal ball, but just war theory does have this, right? The principle of proportionality says you have to look to the potentially foreseeable outcomes, right? Proportionality is forward-looking, the probability of success, but principle is forward-looking. You have to weigh the harms and the benefits, and you have to look quite far, at least in my reading of proportionality. You have to read second, third order of the potential effects of your actions and weigh the second, third order bad effects of your actions. And so the case of targeted killing with the drone program that you're referring to, number one, you have to ask questions of whether or not this is a permissible war. Are we allowed to be there? Is the killing we're doing permissible? If it's not, then no matter what you're doing is going to be wrong. If you're already wrong from the get-go, then you're wrong down the line, right? But if you are engaged in a just war and the people that you're killing are clearly in the wrong, then to me, this doesn't necessarily pose as big of a problem, right? If I'm killing, on Jeff's reading, right, if I'm killing those liable to harm, then they've done something to get me there, killing them. And there are some people who argue that, look, targeted killing is actually much more beneficial than just going in with boots on the ground in large military campaigns that will result in more rights violations. So number one, I think just war theory does have the principle of proportionality that kind of it does look to your concerns about forward unintended consequences and things like this. But also there are questions about the principle of distinction and liability of harm and who's a permissible target and who's not. If you're a pacifist, then everything's wrong from the start and you shouldn't be there. But that's a different set of concerns. If you think that there are justifiable reasons to use lethal force in defense of oneself or in defense of others, then just war theory is attempting to provide those principles. It's not a condoning action all the time, right? It's actually saying it's pretty stringent. You have to meet all of these types of conditions. And even then you can fight that poorly. So I actually will, you know, rally for just war tradition here and say, you know, it is not just saying war is a legitimate activity, no questions asked. It's saying, what is the condition in front of me? And is it doesn't meet these very, very strict conditions in order to be permissible in the first place?
It sounds like what Tom is actually saying is that it's almost impossible to have all of the conditions for a just war met because of what they call collateral damage. I hate that phrase because it does sound so clean when it's not clean, but because of all of the consequences, including blowback and such. So perhaps then a question is it possible to move beyond just war into some kind of just peace? Jeff McMahon.
Many of the philosophers who are considered to be just war theorists have actually given a lot of thought to the claims of pacifism. I've written a couple of papers on pacifism. I know many others have as well. Some people who are in the just war tradition and come to all the just war conferences and so on call themselves pacifists. Pacifism can mean lots of different things, but I tend to think that pacifism depends on a certain approach to moral thinking that primarily is focused on something like the purity of the agent. It says that doing harm is much worse than allowing harm to occur. And that's a contentious principle in moral theory. Most of us hold some version of that. I think the pacifist has to hold a quite strong version of that because, as Tom said, in war, lots of innocent people get killed. They get blown to bits as a side effect. Terrorists kill them intentionally and so on. But one of the reasons for going to war usually is to prevent innocent people from being harmed, killed, tortured, and so on. I mean, I think, for example, that there ought to have been a war conducted by somebody or other, Western powers if necessary, in Rwanda in 1994. Why? Because not doing that meant that 800,000 innocent people were slaughtered with machetes in the course of 6 weeks. Now, I think that could have been stopped. That could have prevented by war that would have killed some innocent people. But I think if you say, well, no, war would have been unjustifiable in the case of Rwanda, what you have to say is that it's impermissible for us to kill 10 innocent people as a side effect, even to prevent 800,000 people from being wrongly killed by somebody else. We should let 800,000 people be wrongly killed by others rather than kill 10 or 100 or 1,000 innocent people ourselves. And that, I think, is a mistaken view in moral theory. I do believe there's an asymmetry between doing and allowing, but it's not that strong an asymmetry.
Just want to let Tom respond to that since this is really addressing some of your concerns.
I take Jeff's point and I, you know, will confess that I'm on difficult terrain there. But one of my general concerns is that just war theory enables us to impose a kind of mirage of moral certainty on what is an incredibly uncertain and contingent realm of human activity. My worry is that it may help us go to bed and sleep well at night, but actually it doesn't necessarily make the world more just. It doesn't make violence necessarily less likely to occur or less harmful. And I guess I just want to be the kind of cheerleader for those of us that don't buy into the just war way of thinking, just to have that debate opened up a little bit wider to take into account some of the model, other moral considerations that don't fall so squarely within the terrain of just war theory.
I'd like to thank the three of you. It's great to have you here. Heather Roth, Jeff McMahon, Tom Gregory, it's been a great pleasure. Jeff McMahon is a professor of philosophy at Rutgers University. He is the author of Killing in War and The Ethics of Killing, Problems at the Margins of Life. Heather Roth Perkins is a professor of international studies at the University of Denver. She is the author of Global Justice, Kant, and the Responsibility to Protect, a Provisional Duty. Tom Gregory is a lecturer of political studies at the University of Auckland, and he's the author of Drones, Mapping the Legal Debate. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.